Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. Salon at 615 is recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Thank you so very much. I, too, wish to thank the mayor's office and the Library Association here and Parnassus Books. And I am really overwhelmed at the level of support and the imagination that you've all put into the events. I'm feeling very unappreciated in my own hometown and thinking that I really would do far better to move here where... It has absolutely been a thrill. I'm going to do a little sound check. Am I okay? I'm looking at the very back, and I can hardly see you, but I think I'm getting a thumbs up. I would like to start by telling you a couple of stories about becoming a writer. And I'm often asked, sort of, you know, for my trajectory, my journey, when I became a writer, how that happened. And there are a number of answers that I give. My most usual one is to tell you all that I became a writer on my 30th birthday, which is sort of the day that I made the absolute decision that it was what I was going to do. But equally true, and the story I'm going to tell you today, is that I became a writer when I was 3 years old. And the reason I am using that one today and telling you that one today is that it begins just barely to express some of the gratitude that I feel to librarians and libraries everywhere. Librarians are my idea of the world's heroes. And if I had my way, no librarian would have a problem that lasted any longer than it took to check out a book and return it. In Bloomington, Indiana, where I lived when I was three, there was a rule that you could get a library card when you could write your name. And my family went to the library every Friday. My father, my mother, my older brother, and I, we all went to the library. We turned in the books that we had gotten last week, and we got out the new books for the coming week. At three, it suddenly became a shame I could no longer endure that I was checking books out on my mother's library card. And I really, really, really wanted my own library card. So I nagged at my mother, to show me how to write my name. And I practiced, and I practiced, and I practiced. And I think in retrospect, it's quite clear to me that no librarian was going to look at whatever I produced and say, no, that will not do. I'm very sorry. But I did not realize that at the time. It seemed to me that the test was setting a pretty high bar, and I'd better be able to get over it. So I did. The next Friday, I went in, I stood in front of the librarian, I wrote my name, she gave me my very first library card. In my family, this was a celebratory event. We came home and my mother had a special dinner made of all my favorite foods to celebrate the fact that I now had a library card. Which is just such a lovely story until I add the detail that my favorite foods at the time were Wonder Bread, coated with quite a thick coating of butter, and then with those little sugar candies sprinkled onto the butter. So I do not remember, but I feel some confidence when I tell you that when my father found out he was eating a sprinkle sandwich for dinner, things probably turned a little ugly. At 11, I moved to Bloomington. I moved from Bloomington, Indiana to Palo Alto, California. I always say I moved from the utopia of Bloomington, Indiana to the hellhole of Palo Alto, California. It's a move I made very, very reluctantly and was very unhappy about. My parents were both native Californians, so for them, our time in Indiana had been a dreadful exile. They could not wait to get back. But I was brokenhearted. And when we arrived, sort of in towards the end of summer, and school had not yet started, and I knew absolutely nobody, my parents signed me up for a reading program at the library. And so I went twice a week to listen as the librarian running the summer program read out loud. I think of that often because I think that I was quite surly about it. I was, again, quite miserable to be in California, and there were only two of us who showed up for this event, and the other girl soon went on vacation, and then it was just me. So twice a week, I would show up, and the librarian would read a story to me, and I would behave in as surly a manner as possible. So this has been weighing on my conscience for a very long time. And I truly believe, although that move was traumatic for me, that I would not be a writer today. So that's yet another answer. I became a writer at 3. I became a writer at 11 when I sort of transformed from a participant in life to more of an observer in life. And I became a writer with the help of this and many other librarians. So I offer that just in case some of you have had the experience of giving a program and having a disappointing turnout and having it appear that nobody actually cares what you're doing, that whatever my appearance, it just saved me. That program, the fact that I had somewhere to go, that I had a story that I could listen to and continue to listen to, was all that got me through those first weeks. So I cannot thank her. I am thanking all of you instead on her behalf. I have now written 6 novels and 3 collections of short stories. It was very momentous for me, briefly, to think that I was writing my 6th novel, which this book is, because I had finally equaled Jane Austen, at least in number of novels, if not in quality. And so I felt that was a real milestone, something we should take a moment and think about. Sadly, when people took a moment to think about it, they said things to me like, I don't understand why her first novel never counts. You know, she really wrote 7 novels. And then they would say, you know, she really wrote 7.5 novels because she was halfway through one when she died. And then they would say, you know, she died at 41. How many novels had you written when you were 41? So I'm just sorry I ever thought it was worth celebrating. I'm going to read you a little part of the novel, just a few pages, and then I'm going to talk to you a bit about it. And I will be leaving time at the end for Q&A. I warn you now that it is my absolutely favorite part of the event, that I will rethink my decision to move to Nashville if you do not have questions for me. So fair warning, you've got a lot of time to be thinking of them. And trust me, I will not leave without them. I am perfectly capable of simply standing here until hands go up. I think the only thing that you need to know in the section I'm reading is that there's an older brother named Lowell, 2 sisters named Rosemary and Fern, and I think that's it. Coincidentally, a complete coincidence, my narrator also grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, and was moved to California. It's odd how that happened. A As part of leaving Bloomington for college and my brand new start, I'd made a careful decision to never, ever tell anyone about my sister Fern. Back in those college days, I never spoke of her and seldom thought of her. If anyone asked about my family, I admitted to two parents, still married, and one brother, older, who traveled a lot. Not mentioning Fern was first a decision and later a habit, hard and painful even now to break. Even now, way off in 2012, I can't abide someone else bringing her up. I have to ease into it. I have to choose my moment. Though I was only 5 when she disappeared from my life, I do remember her. I remember her sharply, her smell and touch, scattered images of her face, her ears, her chin, her eyes, her arms, her feet, her fingers. But I don't remember her fully, not the way Lowell does. Lowell is my brother's name. Our parents met at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona at a high school summer science camp. I'd come to see the heavens, my father always said, but the stars were in her eyes, a line that used to please and embarrass me in equal measure. Young geeks in love. I would think better of myself now if, like Lowell, I'd been angry about Fern's disappearance. But it seemed too dangerous just then to be mad at our parents, and I was frightened instead. There was also a part of me relieved, and powerfully, shamefully so, to be the one kept and not the one given away. Whenever I remember this, I try to also remember that I was only 5 years old at the time. I'd like to be fair here, even to myself. It would be nice to get all the way to forgiveness, though I haven't managed it yet and don't know that I ever will. Or ever should. Those weeks I spent with my grandparents in Indianapolis still serve as the most extreme demarcation in my life, my personal Rubicon. Before, I had a sister, after, none. Before, the more I talked, the happier our parents seemed. After, they joined the rest of the world in asking me to be quiet. I finally became so, but not for quite some time, and not because I was asked. Before, my brother was part of the family. After, he was just killing time until he could be shed of us. Before, many things that happened are missing in my memory, or else stripped down, condensed to their essentials like fairy tales. Once upon a time, there was a house with an apple tree in the yard and a creek and a moon-eyed cat. After, for a period of several months, I seemed to remember a lot. And much of it with a suspiciously well-lit clarity. Take any memory from my early childhood, and I can tell you instantly, whether it happened while we still had Fern or after she'd gone. I can do this because I remember which me was there, the me with Fern or the me without, two entirely different people. Still, there are reasons for suspicion. I was only 5. How is it possible that I remember, as I seem to, a handful of conversations, word for word, the exact song on the radio, the particular clothes I was wearing? Why are there so many scenes I remember from impossible vantage points, so many things I picture from above, as if I'd climbed the curtains and was looking down on my family? And why is there one thing that I remember distinctly, living color and surround sound, but believe with all my heart never occurred? Bookmark that thought, we'll come back to it later. I remember often being told to be quiet, but I seldom remember what I was saying at the time. As I recount things, this lacuna may give you the erroneous impression that I already wasn't talking much. Please assume that I am talking continuously in all the scenes that follow until I tell you that I'm not. Our parents, on the other hand, had shut their mouths, and the rest of my childhood took place in that odd silence. They never reminisced about the time they'd had to drive halfway back to Indianapolis because I'd left Dexter Poindexter, my terry cloth penguin, threadbare, ravaged by love, as who amongst us is not, in a gas station restroom. Although they often talk about the time our friend Marjorie Weaver left her mother-in-law in the exact same place. Better story, I grant you. I know from Grandma Frederica and not our parents, that I once went missing for long enough that the police were called. And it turned out I'd tailed Santa Claus out of a department store and into a tobacco shop where he was buying cigars. And he gave me the ring off one. So the police being called was just an added bonus on what must have already been a pretty good day. I know from Grandma Donna and not our parents that I once buried a dime in some cake batter as a surprise, and one of the graduate students chipped her tooth on it. And everybody thought Fern had done it until I spoke up, so brave and honest, not to mention generous, since the dime had been my own. So who knows what revelries, what romps my memories may have taken with so little corroboration to restrain them. If you don't count the taunting at school, then the only people who talked much about Fern were my Grandma Donna, until Mom made her stop, and my brother Lowell, until he left us. Each had too obvious an agenda to be reliable. Grandma Donna wishing to shield our mother from any share of blame. Lowell stropping his stories into knives. Once upon a time, there was a family with two daughters and a mother and father who'd promised to love them both exactly the same. Thank you. So one of the tricky things about being out on the road with the book is that the way I imagined people reading it, they would not know very much about it when they picked it up. And there is a piece of information that you are missing in the section that I just read about Sister Fern, which comes on page 77 and tells you what the book is really about. So you spend 77 pages, if you read it the way I intended you to, not knowing what the book was about. And I really have my reasons for that, most of which are in the book, so you can read them and either be persuaded or not persuaded. But I did not ever stop to think of the problem I was creating for anybody who wished to sell the book, the marketing department, which said to me, exactly how do you expect us to sell a book when we're not allowed to tell anybody what it's about? Reviewers, who said, don't quite know how to review this book since I'm clearly not supposed to tell you what it's about. And most tragically, me, when I went out. Every time I would go out on the road with the book again, I would think to myself, well, I'm not going to keep the secret any longer because I can't talk about the book, really, without talking about the secret. And then either some review I would read moments before or some person who had read the book would come up to me and say, I hope you're not going to spoil things by telling people what the book is about. And I would just think how sad it would be if the person who spoiled my book for you was me. But as luck would have it, my publisher has put the whole sordid secret on the back cover, and I am no longer trying to keep my own secret. So I am going to tell you how I got the idea for the book, and in telling you that, I will also be telling you what the book is actually about. On the millennial New Year, my daughter, who had heard her whole life about how much happier we would all be in Bloomington, Indiana, told me that she and her boyfriend had a surprise for me. They were going to take me on a trip, and she wasn't going to tell me where, but we were going to spend the millennial New Year's Eve someplace very exciting, and I should just meet them at the airport, and I should pack for cold weather. And where we ended up was Indianapolis, Indiana. My husband did not come with us. He worked for the utility district in Sacramento. You may recollect that the world was ending at midnight, and he was forced to be at his post, ushering us into the Mad Max future that awaited once we hit 12:01 on the clock. So that's too bad. Too bad to be him. Because the rest of us were having a wonderful time in Indianapolis, where we had a complete Hoosier blowout. We went to a Pacers game. We went to a John Mellencamp concert. And we danced until dawn at the Slippery Noodle Blues Club in downtown Indianapolis. And then my daughter and I came down south to Bloomington. My father died before my daughter was born, so much like Bloomington had been a mythical place to her. She said to me once, you know, the way you talk about it, Mom, if I ever get there and it's not like Dorothy stepping into Oz, I am going to think you oversold things. My father, too, is kind of a mythical figure. He died before any of his grandchildren were born. But we went to the building where he used to work. We went to his old lab, which was no longer a lab, but I'm a wordsmith. I was able to bring it all back to life, all the rows and rows of rat cages where my dad trained rats to go through mazes and did studies on learning behavior, and was actually quite a magical place to be when I was a child. I was allowed to take the rats out of the cages on a whim and play with them, and every once in a while one of them would wash out of the research business and come home to be a family pet, which honestly, what a Cinderella story is that. There had been another psychologist at Indiana University, although he left in 1950, which was the year that I was born and the year that we arrived in Bloomington. So as far as I know, my father never crossed paths with him in any way. And yet he had done an experiment so famous in psychological circles that I had heard about it all of my life. And on this occasion, as we were walking through my dad's old lab, for some reason I started to tell my daughter about this experiment. The experiment took place in the 1930s. The psychologist was a man named Winthrop Kellogg. And what Winthrop Kellogg tried to do was he brought an infant chimpanzee home from the Yerkes laboratory at the same time that his wife was giving birth to their infant son. And he tried to raise the two simultaneously. The plan was that he would try to standardize the upbringings in every possible way, give Gua an entirely human upbringing, Gua being the name of the chimpanzee, Donald was the name of the little boy, and see what the difference was, what a human child could do that a chimpanzee could not do, what a chimpanzee could do that a human child could not do, a compare and contrast study. It had unfortunate consequences. What happened, and it came to a fairly quick and early end, because what happened while everybody was focused on Gua picking up whatever human capabilities she was able to pick up, and she is deft. You can go on YouTube and you can see her handling her cup and her fork and her knife and leaving little Donald pretty much in the dust in every possible way. While everybody was focused on Gua being as human-like as her upbringing now allowed her to be, people were missing the fact that Donald was picking up chimp behaviors just as quickly as Gua was picking up human behaviors. And apparently the day the experiment ended was the day that Mrs. Kellogg put little Donald's breakfast cereal in front of him, and he responded with the excited chimp food hoot that suggests something delicious is nearby, which is hoo, hoo, hoo. And Mrs. Kellogg said that is the end of this experiment. And Dr. Kellogg said very quickly that he had already learned everything there was to learn anyway, and little Gua went back to the laboratory, and little Donald went on with his life. So I was telling my daughter this story, and she said, wow, you know, what would it be like to be the child in that experiment? That's what you should write next. I don't have good ideas myself, but I know them when I hear them. And I thought that was a really good idea. I felt concerned that I did not know a lot about chimpanzees. It seemed to me to make this book work, I was going to have to learn a lot about chimpanzees. But I consoled myself that I knew a lot about psychologists. I had been hearing them talk at dinner for as long as I'd been alive, so I know what it's like to be raised by an animal behaviorist. And I am just lucky in that my father's research proved that positive reinforcement was much more effective than anything negative. I am the proud product of nothing but positive reinforcement. It was not a bad childhood, except for the part where I moved to California. So, in the section that I just read to you, Fern is a chimpanzee, something that, again, you do not learn until page 77 of the book, although there have been several references that Rosemary makes to her missing sister. And I chose to conceal this information for as long as I did, again, for the reason that is in the book, but I am also going to stress to you now that we now know, the natural sciences have gone a long way to showing the continuity in the animal kingdom, while the arts and the humanities have continued to hope and insist on human exceptionalism. Neuroscience now has shown us that there is no part of a monkey's brain that a human brain does not share, and vice versa. There is nothing in the human brain that is not also there in the monkey brain. And that the bright line that we have looked for so many years, when I was a child, humans were the tool using animals. But that one has fallen to the side as it's become clear that more and more animals also use tools. Again, the whole world of YouTube is available to you to see these things for yourself. And then during the years in which my book takes place, and I should say that I moved the experiment from the 1930s when the actual experiment took place to the 1970s when there was, in fact, a great kind of craze for home-raising chimpanzees. And although the experiment, which involved a human child, a human infant, was never repeated, there are a number of cases of chimpanzees who were brought into homes and given human upbringing. And most of that took place in the 1970s. So in the 1970s, what people were focused on as the bright dividing line was language. And the early home-raised chimps, the attempt was always to see what they would be capable of linguistically. The early research insisted on trying to make chimps actually speak. The skeletal creation of the chimp's mouth does not allow this. So this was a test the chimps were bound to fail. They could not actually speak verbally. And then they moved to sign language. And Washoe is the first chimp who was, and the most famous of the signing chimps. And now they generally use computer models of various sorts, so the chimps can move symbols around on keyboards and try to communicate that way. But the more we have learned about communication within species, which it startled me when I did the research how long it took. If you're interested in what linguistic capabilities chimps have, it took a very long time for somebody to notice that you might more usefully look at how they communicate with each other and not insist that they learn to communicate with us in order to prove that they have these capabilities. And so the more we learn, the more language also appears to be on its way out as a kind of bright dividing line between humans and other animals. The spirit of my father is all over this book. It is occasionally a great humiliation to me to realize how often I write about my father. I and my second collection of short stories, which were collected but had been published over many years and published in various different places. So I had not actually sat down until it was a book, and I was reading them one after another, and we were talking about what the sequence might be, that I thought, oh my God, I knew I wrote about Dad a lot. I never understood. I never write about anything else. My dad and I started having an argument when I was about six over whether animals could think or not. And this book is in many ways my final refutation of my father's impoverished position. I do think, as luck would have it, research has carried the day for me, and that if my father were still alive, he would be the first to admit it. But he was a psychologist during the B.F. Skinner stimulus response years. In his defense, I will say that if he was not impressed with animals thinking, he was not impressed with human thinking either. When I started to write the book, as I said to you all, I knew that I would have to do a lot of research about chimps, and I did, and it was very pleasurable. All my research has always been very pleasurable, and so I do not mind doing a great deal of it. But I really wanted the book to be about the child. That was the idea that my daughter had had. And as I said, there was only this one experiment that I was aware of that involved a child. But a lot of the 1970s home raising households did have children in them. They had older children in them. And I could find nothing about those children. Look as I would, there was a lot of information about the experiments. There was a lot of information about the chimpanzees. It was not easy, but it was possible to find out what happened to the chimpanzees when the experiments ended. And I should take this moment just to say, as a quick aside, that I truly believe that the people who did these experiments in the 1970s had the best of intentions and thought that the chimp would be a member of the family forever, that the chimp would, was a permanent addition to the household. And it is really only in the 1970s that we came to realize, as the family in my book comes to realize, that you cannot keep an adult chimp in a family household. They are very, very dangerous animals, I'm sure. I'm sure you're aware of some of the attacks there have been, some of the horrific attacks that there have been. So the chimps did not stay in the family households until they died. They all had to be removed. And as I said, it was difficult, but it was possible to find out where they went and what happened to them. But there was nothing about the children. So I had to make that up. Fortunately, I am a novelist. At some point, reluctant as I may be, I am ready to make things up. And I thought long and hard about my character, trying to imagine. Again, current science suggests that our infant brains are very malleable, and that the creatures that you spend a lot of time with have an effect on the actual architecture of your brain. And so little Donald Kellogg's brain was changed by the experiment, by the actual experiment, and my character, and in my book, the experiment lasts much longer because I wanted her to have some memories of it. So it lasts until she's five. I have to think that she has a slightly different brain than the rest of us do, and I had to try to imagine what that might look like and what that might be like. And that was great fun. Interestingly, since the book came out, I have heard from a couple of people who were raised with chimpanzees. So that information that would have been so useful to have when I was writing the book is now at my fingertips. And I sort of have thought in my head what a great New Yorker article it might make if I could, interview some of these people and hear what they all had to say. But the thing in the three people who've gotten in touch with me in some detail, it has become very clear that although they are willing to share the story with me because I have written the book and am obviously interested, it is not a story that they want to talk about publicly. That I have not met or heard from a person who who did not feel pretty disturbingly traumatized by the whole event. In different ways. In at least one case, the chimp in the house was such a horrible bully that she spent her childhood kind of terrified. She's the only one I've heard that from. Most of the chimps are remembered very fondly, but they do take up an enormous amount of time and attention, and there was a thread, which I think I did, as luck would have it, get kind of right, of sibling rivalry and sibling envy, that the chimps were so much more colorful, so much more interesting, so much more entertaining than the sad, sad human child, that it was a hard household to be in. Again, you know, when I talk about the book, when I talk about any book, I have noticed how often interviewers and reviewers and me, when I'm talking about my books, how often we, as fiction writers, focus on the parts that are real. That, you know, I hear Terry Gross interviewing some novelist, and there's often a kind of thread, well, which parts of this book actually happened to you? Well, you lived in Bloomington, Indiana, so how much of that is autobiographical? And my books are all very research-based, so there's that non-fictional element to talk about as well. It is, I understand why we sort of light on that as our subject when we're talking about the books, as I have just done, because it's so much easier to talk about than the parts that you made up, which come, who knows? People keep asking me where I came up with the title. I don't have a clue. Suddenly it was there in my brain. This is a complete aside, and yet I have opened the door to it, so I will finish it, that I have just realized, people have been asking me, there's a puppet in the book of Madame Defarge, you know, where in the world Madame Defarge came from, and I thought I had sort of tracked it back and could give you an answer to that question, but I recently realized that the woman who was the first human mother for Nim Chimpsky, one of the more famous of the home-raised chimps, was Stephanie Lafarge. And so I think in that sadly literal way that my brain had the name Lafarge somewhere lodged in it, and you know, there you are at Defarge. It's not a big leap. So again, you know, I have talked a lot about the research, about the animal elements of the book. I really do think of it as a book about a girl. I think of it as her telling the story of her family and her speaking on behalf of her family. Because the chimp experiments were so language-focused, the book is very language-focused, and I spent a lot of time with each character, sort of thinking about who talks and who doesn't talk, and who's listened to and who isn't listened to, and what the relationship to language of each character in the book would be. So I also feel that I generally fail to make the book sound as funny as I hope that it is. There were times when I could hardly type. I was laughing so hard at my own hilarious inventions. And I think that we have some time for questions, which I told you to have ready. So don't fail me now. Yes, start in the middle. Yes, the question is what my thought process on starting in the middle was, which actually makes me realize that I never quite finished my story about why I withheld the information about Fern. That I wanted to write a book in which what we now know from our neurological studies and primate studies appears to be true, that that there is a continuation, that there is no bright line between us and the other great apes, but sort of a dotted line instead. That I wanted the reader to start with that feeling of of identity, you know, not with difference, but with similarity. I wanted the reader to meet Fern as a sister before the reader met Fern as a chimp, because I just believed, sorry to be so faithless in all you readers, I just believed you would feel differently about her if I had told you at the outset that she was a chimp, and I wanted you to feel the same about her. I have now had two Q&A sessions where somebody has raised their hand and said that, you know, the mother's breakdown when Fern is removed from the family just seemed so over the top to them that, you know, it was as if a human child had been removed from the family. And I thought, okay, I did not make my case persuasively enough for you, apparently. But yes, that's what I was trying to say. Also, just as luck would have it, the middle of a book, plotting is not something I'm strong on. And I have spent so much time, so much more time than I can even share with you, trying to plot my books and trying to plot them in such a way that reviewers will no longer say, of course, one doesn't read Fowler for plot. And I truly believe that I have learned to plot now. And the fact that the reviews continue to say that is troubling to me, as I think, no, now I'm plotting really well. It's a shame it's so invisible to you that I'm doing so. But as part of my difficulty with plot, the middle is always the hardest part of the book for me. I love setting the novel up. I love putting all of the characters in place. I love setting and all of the things that you do in the first 100 pages. When, you know, the book could be anything, it still has such promise, it still has such potential. You have not yet failed, as you soon will when you reach the middle. And I love the ending. By the time I get to the ending, which I do not know in general when I start out, but by the time I get there, I do know it. So it's a, you know, that there are identifiable tasks to be done. I can do them. I know what I want the ending of the book to be. What remains is the middle. And I frequently turn my novels in to my beloved editor, who says, well, there's a lot of to and froing in the middle of your book, which I take to mean that people are running around with great excitement as if things are happening, and yet there is no sense of forward movement. And, you know, that the task of having set everything up and then having to just kind of keep it all not only in the air, but in the air in increasingly tense ways, that, you know, like the plates are surely about to drop now, is just really grim for me. And so because I wanted what I wanted with Fern, it occurred to me that this was also an opportunity to write the part of the book I don't like first, and then all that would remain would be the parts I liked, the beginning and the end. And it worked, I think, a treat. I loved it. I'm wondering how many books I can do the same thing in before people will start to notice. Yes. I am always asked a question of this sort, and I've been asked what my writing schedule and habits are. So my first response is to ask a question back to you. Do you want to know what my writing schedule has been like up until today, or do you want to know starting tomorrow what my writing schedule is going to look like? And I'm betting that you want the first. I teach a lot, and I truly believe, and I tell my students that I truly believe, that a real writer gets up, hits the desk at about the same time every day, you know, works steadily. Carolyn Forché, the poet, I took a class with her when I was just learning to write, and she said, don't make the muse track you down in the grocery store. You be in the same place so that she knows where to find you. Such good advice. Like I said, this is what real writers do. Tragically, I have never been able to maintain a schedule of that sort. On any given week, I will be lucky to do that twice. And it would make, it would all be so understandable if I could say to you, well, you know, my family is really demanding, or, you know, my husband is ill, or, you know, something, anything. But in point of fact, my typical day truly does look like this. Obviously, not every day, or I would never get anything done, but this is my typical day. I get up and I go for a very long walk. I've started wearing a jawbone up. I don't know if any of you know what this is, but you're supposed to have 10,000 steps a day. So I like to get that done before breakfast. Then I have breakfast. Then I look at my email. There are usually a few things that really do require a pretty quick response, and I respond to those. And then there are several websites that I like to check in on. They usually involve things that are happening with the people who supposedly represent me in Sacramento or Washington or wherever my irritation is focused at the moment. But I think, you know, I bet while I was sleeping, people have done things I do not approve of. And I should go see what those are. And sure enough, I am never disappointed. Then I think, I bet I have some answers to those emails I sent out earlier this morning. And I go and look, and I do. And some of them require immediate attention. And then I think, well, I've been at my email now for about half an hour. I bet my government has done something I'm unhappy about. And I go and look, and they have. There are many petitions needing to be signed. And it is incredibly, horribly possible for me to circle between my email and my politics, and my email and my politics, until about 3, when I'm tired. And I couldn't possibly work. I'm all worn out. And then I go to bed thinking, damn, I really wanted to write today. And filled with a completely pointless self-loathing because it does not make me behave better on the following day. I write in fits and starts. I frequently now am given retreat time. And I'd get a lot done on my books in those, you know, incredibly. I'm always, again, filled with self-loathing. I think how Jane Austen wrote her books, you know, in the busy kitchen with everything going on around her. But apparently I cannot write unless somebody is making my breakfast and making my lunch and taking the internet away from me, more to the point. Yes, in the back. Yes. I'm being asked. I think the sort of overall question is the mix of tones, the kind of lighthearted, and then the very, very difficult emotional stuff that the book also includes. I think as a general rule, that the more upset I am about something, the funnier I get. And that is my coping mechanism. And I've had friends call me up when I've published some terribly tragic story to check in and see if I'm all right. And I've always said to them, you don't get it. You know, when the story is funny, then this phone call is necessary. But I can't be unhappy in my imaginary world as well as my real world. And so the only times that I'm able to write really difficult stuff is if I'm actually doing pretty well and feeling pretty good. I did know from the outset that I would be dealing with a number of things that would be very upsetting to me to deal with. Most of them involve the use of animals in our food production, in, you know, cosmetics production, and in research. You know, that obviously is an unavoidable part of the topic at hand. And as I said, it was possible when I started doing the research to go and learn what had happened to the chimps in the actual experiments. One of the things that is true of these chimps is that, of every single one of the home-raised chimps, is that when shown photographs of people and chimps and asked to sort them into the separate piles, chimps in one pile, humans in another, they do that perfectly with the exception of their own picture, which they put in the human pile. So they believe in themselves as human beings, and then, you know, at age 5 or 6, or in the case of Lucy, age 12, some completely other place has to be found for them. I knew this was a tragic story that I was telling. And again, you know, I guess I wouldn't want to read a story like that if there weren't funny parts too. I wouldn't be able to get through the story if part of it wasn't funny. And the other thing, in answer to your particular question about Rosemary going to kindergarten, again, you know, I was trying to imagine the child who had spent 5 years with one of her closest companions having these behaviors and what it would be like for her. I think of a lot of Rosemary's issues as just extreme examples of what I imagine the human condition to be. That I hope I'm not just speaking for myself here. I hope there will be nodding and agreement that that I think we all have moments where we wonder how normal we are. And you know, you're at a dinner party and you say something and there's just a sort of stunned silence and you think, oh well, that's just me then. Never mind. So I think that's a human way to feel. Rosemary has more cause than most to wonder that. And I also, you know, this was something that I saw when my children were in kindergarten that was interesting to me, sad to me, and inexplicable to me, that there would be children in the class who, to the adult eye, looked like every other child in the class. There was nothing you could see that was wrong with this child, and yet the children would ostracize that person. There was something they saw that was, again, invisible to the adults, but that the children all seemed to share, a sense that this was not, you know, this person was not part of the group. And so I had that very much in mind, too. I thought Rosemary would certainly be one of those people that whatever the well-meaning adults in her life were trying to do, the children would see instantly, no, there is something not right here. I'm being asked about the part of the book that deals with memory. Again, you know, I made the experiment last 5 years because I wanted Rosemary to be able to remember some of it in a way that the original subject, Donald Kellogg, obviously at 16 months, would not. Having made that decision, I had to think about, you know, sort of for myself, starting with myself, what do I actually remember about being 5 years old? I think I remember actually quite a lot, but I have an older brother who is nothing like Lowell, I will say, the least angry person you would ever want to meet, and who can corroborate certain memories that I have for me, but who continually refuses to do so. almost in every case says, no, that's not the way it happened. That's not the way it happened. And when my mother was still alive, she always took his side. So, you know, I've been interested as a writer probably too in how we use our memories to create a narrative of our lives. And, you know, we have some evidence, but we tend to make it fit, whatever. Like, I believe I had a very happy childhood. I have created a narrative for myself in which I had an extremely happy childhood. I don't actually know if I did or not. You know, there was certainly, looking back, there was nothing to trouble me. As an adult, I had no problems that I would, as an adult, consider real problems. But, you know, your problems are as big as you think they are. And if, as a child, you think it's a problem, then it's a problem. So I lived through, in the 1970s, again, this great revolution in our feelings about memory, mostly involving sexual abuse and recovered memory. And I think that we all learned that our memories are just not nearly as reliable as we thought they are, that it is very easy for us to recast them to shape a narrative that we want. But even more startlingly, it is apparently extremely easy for someone else to persuade us that we remember something that actually never happened. And in the case of my book, I also looked at Freud, who says we have no memories of our childhood at all. That, you know, we have what he called screen memories. So, you know, the things that happen in our lives, we create a new story out of, and then we remember the memory rather than the event. I did have one early reader tell me that in a what she thought was already a pretty complicated novel, that the unreliability of Rosemary's memory she thought was a step too far. But I don't see how it would be plausible any other way. I, at some point, will, when we have more time, I will ask you all to tell me what you remember from being 5 years old, but not tonight, I guess. Yes. Profoundly, I think. More profoundly than any other novel I have written. When I started the novel, I was upset on behalf of chimpanzees. I thought that they were too similar to us to have been used in the ways that they had been used. And in the course of writing the book, I took a class, I audited a class at UC Santa Cruz on animal cognition, and realized, you know, sort of with a great shock, how limited that vision was. You know, if, why is the only reason I'm going to be sympathetic to an animal if it can prove it's human-like? You know, why can't my sympathy extend a little further than that? And so I got very caught up in animal cognition, have done a lot of reading even since I finished the book, because it's a fast-moving field and it's an incredibly exciting field and a very surprising one. You know, we have underestimated the animals that we share the planet with at every possible turn, and they always turn out to be capable of more than we imagined that they were. Usually when I research a book, I start out very broad and I end up very focused, and I had exactly the opposite experience. I started out very focused and my research just got broader and broader and broader, and I have not been able to move on to the next book, although it's been several years now of email and politics. But it seems, you know, but as I said, it had a lot to do with my father. It had a lot to do with my argument with my father. It seems to have come from someplace so deep inside me that it just has taken out of me more than novels usually take out of me. And I do feel very, well, for one thing, I'm suddenly a chimp expert. Who would have thought? I get frequent requests to write things about chimps for various publications, and I think, you know, the time I have spent with chimps is one day in one laboratory, but I have read a lot. There was another question there. What happens in my writing process when I'm away from my computer? First of all, I am filled with the desire to write when I am away from my computer. It is compelling. It vanishes the minute I am reunited with my computer. But when I wrote my first novel, there was a period where I just had sank so deeply into it that every waking minute, my kids, quickly sensing weakness as children do, would ask me for permission to do something, and the next thing I would know, they would be shouting to each other, "She said yes!" And I would think, "Oh my God, what have I said yes to?" And I thought it would always be that way. That's sort of, that's the image you have from Little Women, that Jo goes into the vortex, and it's wonderful when it happens. But it's a lot, for me, it's rarer and more to be treasured than I realized. Since it happened with my first novel, I did not understand that that was not the way it was always going to be. But when a novel is doing really well, when I am doing really well on a novel, that's the state that I'm in, where, yeah, I'm thinking about it all the time. I would love to go on, but I am over the time I was told. What, can I take another question, or? Thank you so much. I am being praised for the end of my book. Thank you. Thank you.